So I said at the beginning of the first talk about being in India, about living in India, and in preparing these talks, thinking about these talks, I've just had a lot of memories of my time in India, and it's quite interesting. Sanghanath is here in Sudhi, and also Amitayus, you might have noticed, a new arrival to Kathmandu. Amitayus is visiting from India, from a centre in Amaravati in Vidarbha part of India. He's the Mitra convener of the centre, and we just had a really lovely conversation. I met Amitayus long ago, but I don't think I met you as Amitayus, did I? I didn't meet you when you were ordained, I don't think. Okay, so it's been very good to meet him and reminisce about India. I mean, it isn't surprising that these talks should elicit lots of memories of India, because the Sutra of Golden Light has a lot of Indian culture within it. It's an expression of Indian culture, or rather the transcultural, universal golden light of the Dharma is expressing itself through Indian culture. Very important to remember that, that although there's a lot of Indian culture in it, the message transcends Indian culture for all times and all places. And especially it expresses itself in the sutra with the appearance of the different Indian gods and goddesses. And reading through the transcripts of Bhante's talks, there are so many references to his own experience of Indian culture. In the first lecture we looked at, he looked at Saraswati and the whole puja season in India where Saraswati is worshipped and so on. In the lecture on Durga, there's a reference to lots of other Indian goddesses like Durga and Kali. And in the lecture on Sri, on Buddhist economics, he talks quite a lot about Lakshmi, the Hindu goddess of wealth. And when I lived in India, almost every day, I would see this imagery. It would just be everywhere you went. But when thinking about this last talk, which is related to the last of Bhante's talks, called The Moral Order and Its Upholders, which is really about the golden light and its effect, its transformation of the social order, what came to my mind was not any of the Indian gods and goddesses, but a very different experience of mine. It happened during my first visit to India in, I think it was around 1979 or 1980. That was what, about 22, 23, something like that. And this is when, during the time when Lokamitra was starting things in Pune and in other parts of India. And this experience came in the context of a regular meditation and Dhamma class that I used to lead in Pune. It was a class in a flat not far from Pune railway station, the main Pune railway station, Pune Junction. And it was, the flat was owned by a really lovely Buddhist family. In fact, I think the father of the house, Mr. Moray, was, worked on, the railways in those days. And it was a big extended family. And we used to have these lovely classes. When I got there, I'd always be getting lovely sweet tea and, snacks, and then after the class, of course, I had to stay for a really lovely meal, you know, served by the daughters of the house, and one of those daughters is now a Dharmachari. Although it was a small room, this flat, it was always packed full for the meditation and the Dharma talk afterwards, and the discussion that we had after the talk. Fantastic atmosphere that we had. And this particular day was the 6th of December. I think I've got the right date, the 6th of December, which is a very special day. It's the anniversary of Dr. Ambedkar's death. Have I got that right? 6th of December? Yes? Yeah. Thank you. So it would have been a special evening. I mean, not because I was, you know, very much a junior, young, obscure order member. It wasn't a big program or anything like that. I mean, later on, 6th of December programs were, I'd be invited to give a big talk and all that sort of thing. But this was something much more modest. And I was filling in really for Loka Mitra. I think Loka Mitra was away on tour somewhere teaching the Dharma, probably doing a big 6th of December program somewhere. And during the day, that day, there were speeches given by different Buddhist political leaders down particularly near the railway station at a place called Dr. Ambedkar Uyan, Dr. Ambedkar Garden. There was a big statue of Dr. Ambedkar, and it was a sort of focus for all sorts of meetings and rallies and things like that. You have to remember that the Buddhist community in India arose out of the Dalit community, which would have been regarded back in the day as untouchable, so we don't use that word. There's a strong social and political aspect to things. And in the late 1970s and early 80s, that wasn't that long after a period of truly terrible violence by police and caste Hindus in an area of Maharashtra called Marathwada district. I mean, really, really dreadful violence. Villages, Buddhist villages razed to the ground, murder, rape, everything. Not just, and perpetrated by the police as much as anything else. And that kind of violence is always a threat, was always a threat, still is a threat. And in the course of these speeches down at Dr. Ambedkar's statue near the station, for reasons I never understood, the police did what's known as a lathi charge on the assembled Buddhists, the Dalits, community listening to these speeches. Lathis are big, heavy bamboo truncheons. They're really, really hard. They're long and thick. And they did a charge. And indiscriminately, men, women, children, young, old, seriously injuring many, killing some. It wasn't a violent demonstration by the Buddhist community, I should say. People were just there to mark the death anniversary of Dr. Ambedkar. And of course, I heard about this. You find out about these things. If you're just living in a around a community like that, the word goes out. And so I went to do the class as usual, and people were coming in, and there was a very, very somber mood indeed. People were coming in, some people were coming from being at that program and they'd managed to avoid the violence. And there was a very, very sad and somber atmosphere. People were very shaken, very upset. And we all sat together. And I was asked a question by one of the women present, a very good friend who eventually became an order member, an old disciple of Bhante, Dharma Lochanar. And she asked this question. She wasn't an order member then. She said, "What can your metta bhavana do against this?" Quite directly. And I have to admit that I really didn't know how to answer that question in that moment. I didn't know what to say. I felt out of my depth. Suddenly I was in a very different world. This was not teaching meditation and Buddhism to help people in London relax or to have an ecstatic religious experience or something like that, to sort out their problems. This was, I was in a situation where the Dhamma, I'm going to use the word, the Pali, Dhamma, because that's, Dr. Ambedkar feels that that's a much better word than Dharma, which has all sorts of Hindu connotations. So let's use the word Dhamma. This was the Dhamma in relation to violent oppression and a corrupt society. And I felt actually well out of my depth. I'm someone who you can probably gather can usually find something to say. I'm rarely lost for words, but I couldn't speak. I didn't know what to say. I felt, I suppose, genuinely humbled by the situation. I think in the end, I said, "Well, let's just sit together. Let's just sit together. Let's just sit quietly together. In silence, let's just do that, and we'll do some puja, I think that's what we did in the end. And we were just together in the Dharma, in the Sangha, in front of the Buddha, in front of the shrine. And that experience gave me much to think about regarding being a Buddhist in a violent and unjust world, with people who experience that violence, injustice and inequality directly, day in and day out, which and where there was always the threat of a sort of explosion. And during the years I spent in India, I began to see the Dhamma much more as a revolutionary force, not a violent revolutionary force, a peaceful revolutionary force. But I saw, I guess, the potential for that. I began to see what the possibility of what Bhante called the Dhamma Revolution. He gave a very famous talk in Bombay in the 1980s, which came to be called the Dhamma Revolution, where he puts forward a number of ideas, a number of a bit of a sort of program to bring about the Dhamma Revolution. And I also began to see the potential for the Dhamma Revolution because of just hearing people's life stories. Even people who were around in the early days of the conversion movement, there were still people alive from who were young people when Dr. Ambedkar converted in 1956 and the conversions that followed afterwards. I met people from those times. And I could see that the Dhamma had completely transformed their life. Even though it might not have brought about immediate social change, their total outlook on life was liberated. It was a liberated attitude. In leaving Hinduism, in going for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, they had taken full responsibility for their lives. They had stepped out of something oppressive and they'd stepped into freedom. It was very, very striking talking to people, from those times. And also living and working with Indian Buddhists. And I would say that some of our most outstanding, members of our order live in India. You'll never get to meet them. Some of the most outstanding, committed people are in India. Getting to know them, developing friendships with them, strong friendships with them in some cases, and developing feeling respect for them. And of course, studying the life and work of Dr. Ambedkar, Baba Sahib, and Bhante's exposition of his thought and literature in that really important book, Ambedkar and Buddhism. I would strongly urge you to read that if you want to know about Dr. Ambedkar and Buddhism. So this had a very, very big effect on me. I think it's had one of the strongest effects on me in terms of my understanding and appreciation of the Dharma, living in India. Dr. Ambedkar was probably the first person in modern times, the first person perhaps for centuries, who saw the Dhamma, who experienced the Dhamma as a force, as the force of social revolution. That's not an exaggeration. Sangharakshita said that in Dr. Ambedkar was only a formally a Buddhist. I think he'd been a Buddhist for a lot longer, but formally a Buddhist, I think for 8 weeks. And Bhante says in Ambedkar and Buddhism, he did more for Buddhism in India since Emperor Ashoka. When did Emperor Ashoka live? First century of the Common Era, something like that. That is quite a statement. More for Buddhism in India, more for Buddhism in the world in 8 weeks through taking so many people into the Dhamma. I think before Dr. Ambedkar, certainly in the West, perhaps in the East as well, the Dhamma wasn't really regarded as having social significance, even political significance at all. I think that's fair to say. The Dhamma was regarded as more to do with something meditative and philosophical. Even it would be branded as a kind of quietism. Actually, that has never been a traditional way of regarding the Dhamma. You know, we know that the Buddha was, of course, a renunciate living in the forest and, had gone forth and gained enlightenment through the profound practice of meditation and wisdom. But the social, revolutionary, even political revolutionary implications are there right at the beginning of the Buddha's teaching. And this must be kept in mind. If we don't, we distort the effect of the Buddha's teaching. In one of the oldest sections of the Pali Canon, where it describes various things that happen after the Buddha's enlightenment, one of the earliest things to happen was a conceited and haughty Brahmin coming to the Buddha and asking him the question, what makes a true Brahmin? What makes a truly noble man, a true spiritual man? And, you could even say, what makes the highest man in society? And the Buddha's answer is unequivocal. It's nothing to do with birth. It's nothing to do with caste. The highest man, the best man, is someone who practices pure morality, who develops knowledge and wisdom and insight, who has purity of mind. And it's quite clear that the Buddha is anti-caste, anti-untouchability as well. You find some amazing passages in the Pali Canon where the Buddha says what a true outcast is. It's nothing to do with the family you're born into. It's to do with your morality. It's to do with your ethics. That's what makes you truly outcast. So his enlightenment is, in other words, impacting on the structures of society around him. When you entered the Bhikshu Sangha, all caste names are left behind. Ordination is a spiritual death, a kind of death of all, well, not just a spiritual death, it's actually a death of all social status and standing. The Buddha says of his disciples, they become Sakyaputta summoners, wanderers who are sons of the Sakyan, who are sons of the Buddha. That's all they are. It's very interesting as well, when the Buddha went back to the Sakya country and all of these cousins and relations of his went forth into the homeless life, he ordained Upali first. Upali was a barber, low caste, in other words. So that meant he was senior in the order to all these people who were at one time Kshatriya. So the point is very, very clear, again and again in the Buddha's teaching. The Sutra of Golden Light also has a chapter devoted to society and the proper governance of the world. And it's in the chapter entitled Instruction Concerning Divine Kings. It's chapter 12 of the Sutra. And Bhante explores this chapter in the last of his lectures, The Moral Order and Its Upholders. Though he does, by the way, say that he wasn't entirely happy with the phrase The Moral Order and Its Upholders, because it, perhaps connotes something, moral order. It's not a very, certainly in the 1970s, it wasn't a very fashionable way of speaking. Actually, the chapter doesn't mention the Sutra of Golden Light. As Bhante says in his introduction to the Sutra, the Sutra of Golden Light, especially the confession section, just seems to attract to it lots of floating material. But he sees it very much, this chapter, as the golden light impacting on the social order. The chapter begins with a homage being paid to a Buddha with a very, very, very long name, which I'm not even going to try and say. And then a homage to the Tathagata Shakyamuni, then a homage to Sri and Sarasvati and so on. And then it tells a story. It tells a story about a king named Balendra Ketu, who had just consecrated his son, Rujira Ketu. He'd consecrated him as the next king. This was the ancient Indian practice in kingship. The old king would consecrate, he'd give the Abhisheka, as it's called, to his son, so that he was anointed as the next king. And the old king would then go off into solitary retreat and practice as a hermit. It's very interesting in the Pali Canon. There's a number of Jataka stories. This is in the Sutta Pitaka, where the Buddha tells a story of a previous life when he was a king and he handed over the kingship to his son and then went off into retreat. And what did he practice in retreat? The Brahma Viharas. Love, compassion, sympathetic joy, equanimity. You might have something to say about this a little later, the significance of that. He'd go off to practice meditation and absorb himself in the Brahma Viharas. Valendra Ketu told his son Ruchira Ketu, after he'd consecrated him, that his father, Virendra Ketu, had given him a textbook, a Nidesha, a treatise, on how to rule, called Instruction Concerning Divine Kings. And because of that, Valendra Ketu says that he had never taken the side of anyone unlawfully, even if only for the measure of a single moment's thought. He had never taken the side of anyone unlawfully, even if only for the measure of a single moment's thought. In other words, he'd never sided with someone who'd broken the law, who'd actually broken the precepts, who'd been unskillful. He'd never sided with them. He then expounded to Ruchira Ketu the instruction concerning divine kings. And the first part of it is, well, it's the mythology of ancient Indian kingship, or a mythology of ancient Indian kingship. He tells a story of Brahma, the king of the gods, being with the four great kings, and the four great kings, the Lokapalas, have got a sort of problem. These are the four kings that rule over the strange and mysterious forces of the universe. They have this question: why is a king, though born among men, called divine, called Deva? And how does he exercise kingship? Bhante points out that in ancient India, kings were often called Deva. He said it's a bit like, you know, when you say Your Majesty, they're addressed as Deva. Brahma replies that a king, before he enters his mother's womb, is blessed by the gods. So there's a portion of the gods in him when he is born. He even says, this is really strange, that in fact, although the king appears like a man, he actually has an illusory body. Whoa. He looks like a man, but he's really from another dimension. So, first thing to reflect upon here, we have to remember that in Buddhist tradition, when we talk about the gods, we're talking about something quite different from the Hindu vision of the gods. This is the Buddhist notion of god realms. The Buddhist tradition has a very different notion of god realms. The god realms are the objectification of higher states of consciousness. They're the objectification of dhyana states. Highly skillful states, intensive. You know, the gods are dwelling in intensively skillful states, although completely mundane and conditioned. You know, you can fall away from them, but higher nonetheless. So the king is a manifestation on earth, according to this, of that higher skillful state. And his primary function, therefore, is to encourage skillful action in men, in human beings, to encourage skillful action on earth. And even to go further, to reward people who engage in skillful action, and to even punish those who behave unskillfully. And the laws of the land must be based entirely on skillfulness and unskillfulness. It doesn't say how the punishment happens, and I'm not going to go into punishment and all that sort of thing. In the text it says, whether the Lord of men is a man, a god, a Gandharva, that's a sort of celestial musician, a Rakshasa, which is a sort of demon, an untouchable, he removes evil deeds. He removes unskillful deeds. It's very, very significant. Again, you know, you've got the anti-caste language. It's saying that an untouchable can be a king, I mean, that goes right against the Hindu tradition, which is it's only Kshatriyas who are kings. But it's saying that, well, any kind of being could be a king, so long as he is encouraging skillfulness, he is discouraging unskillfulness. And then there's this wonderful phrase, the king is the parent of those who do good deeds. The king is the parent of those who do good deeds. So it's as if in ancient Indian kingship here, the king is the father of the nation, and his responsibility is to be the parent of those who do good deeds and to encourage goodness in the sense of skillfulness throughout the land. The king nurtures those who act skillfully. And the sutra then goes on to speak of the dire consequences if evil deeds, if unskillfulness is allowed to go on. And if the king aligns himself with unskillful activity. Disaster happens on a huge scale. Civil unrest, that things go wrong with the asterisms, you know, astrology, the stars get messed up, nature gets messed up, everything gets out of kilter. He also talks about the benefits of encouraging and rewarding skillful action. And one of these is that the realm of the devas, the realm of the gods, the realm of skillfulness, of higher states of consciousness increases, and the realm of the demons, those destructive forces in the world, in society, is depleted. Happiness and blessing fills the land. There's a sense of growth and abundance. In other words, the force of good is triumphing. So what the text is saying is that a king governs and orders his country according to the Buddhist law of karma, to the Buddhist law of karma, not to any other law of karma, the Buddhist law of karma. And he's completely impartial in his governance. This is the point that's made. He doesn't favour his family. He doesn't favour his extended family. He doesn't favour people if they're useful to him. He isn't interested in power at any cost. He rules according to the natural ethical law, the law of karma, and all the laws are based on that. That's the vision. The laws of the land are based upon the Buddhist law of karma. And as you know, very, very simply, the law of karma runs like this. Skillful action proceeding from a mind filled with contentment, generosity, non-harm, love, awareness, wisdom, and so on, leads to happiness, well-being, growth for oneself and others. Unskillful action proceeding from greed, hatred, delusion, jealousy, conceit, resentment, all the rest of them, leads to suffering, restriction, imprisonment, bondage of self and other. Very, very simple. That's the way it is. So you can see from this why a king would need to be divine. Actually, I think a king would need to be a bodhisattva to rule in this way. He'd need a lot more than just the mundane qualities that come through the god realms. I think a king like this would need certainly a touch of the transcendental, a touch of the golden light to really rule in this way. They'd need immense wisdom, I think, to do it. Indeed, anybody in positions of governance, anybody in positions of responsibility, which involves other people in any sphere of life, need to be people of great wisdom and skill and human maturity. I think that, I know fathers start to feel this, my friends who've become fathers, suddenly everything changes in the way they conduct themselves, or even within our own order and movement, when people take a particular responsibility of one kind or another, suddenly they realise that they're having a big impact on other people, much bigger than they actually realise. We can also see why, perhaps, in ancient India, a king, after consecrating his son, would go off into retreat to meditate on the Brahma Viharas, to dwell in love and compassion, sympathetic joy and equanimity, to dwell in the bodhicitta, Perhaps because it's just been very difficult to fully live according to them with all the complexities of the life of governance. Perhaps it's to engage in purification, because no matter how well you do, even if you yourself were really pure, you might have to take a lot of stuff from other people, which can be very, very difficult to bear. We often talk about the way that we're governed. We often complain about the way that we're governed, and our leaders, and in all sorts of areas, our political leaders, our business leaders, and you know, the people in the media and so on. It's a common cause of complaint that we can go into. We can even be appalled by what people in power do, and we can feel helpless as well. Helpless because sometimes it's just very hard to even know what the truth is, to know how something has turned out the way it's turned out, or even to feel that you can, how can I possibly affect these incredible forces? Perhaps it's less clear, though, about what we would do and what we can do. I remember we were having a conversation, I think, about terrible things happening in the Middle East, and Dharmadeepa sort of jumped in and said, but what would we do? It's all very well saying it's like this and like that, but do we really know what we would do? And he sometimes thought that sometimes Buddhists, some Buddhists he met, as if you know, they've got all the answers in relation to very complicated world problems. And I thought it was a very good thing to point out to those of us talking. Perhaps the first thing we need to be really clear about, and I think probably we're not clear about, is the centrality of the law of karma to Buddhist practice. The centrality of the law of karma to Buddhist practice. I would say insight into karma and its effects, into skillfulness and unskillfulness and their effects, is the fundamental and the most important insight that anybody could possibly have. It's much more important than an insight into not-self. Seeing the way karma works in yourself. Seeing, really seeing, how skillfulness leads to positive effects, how unskillfulness leads to negative effects. Seeing that your actions have consequences. This is what Dada Rinpoche wanted his pupils to have really got when they left his care. Not that they would be Buddhists, but they understood that their actions had consequences. He meant by that insight into the law of karma. Bhante in his lecture points out that really the Buddha is the first teacher to teach karma. In this way. Nobody was talking about karma before the Buddha in the way that he talks about it, in the way Buddhists define it. This moral ordering of the cosmos, of the world, based on our intention, our will, our volition, our chaitana, our sanskaras. They are doing things. They are affecting ourselves. They are affecting they are affecting our future. They are affecting other people. And we really need to take responsibility for them. Nothing happens by chance. And of course, the law of karma is part of the wider and general teaching of conditioned co-production. The coming into being out of conditions to give rise to further conditions. And Sangharakshita has developed this idea very strongly with his teaching on the five niyamas, and I'd recommend reading Revering and Relying on the Dharma to really have a good look at his teaching on the niyamas, the different orders of conditionality. So before we can talk or even think about the golden light transforming society, we need ourselves to wake up to the law of karma. We need to see it working in us. We need to have that basic conviction, even conviction before insight, conviction but of the effects of our actions and take full responsibility for our mental states and the actions that proceed from those mental states. We really do need to see that our mental states and our actions of body, speech and mind is an act, mind is a karma in Buddhism, it's an action. We need to see, we need to feel that they're sending out, if you like, vibrations, energies, waves, ripples, which will return, which do affect, which will affect us in the future, which will affect others in the future. We will be experiencing joy if we act skillfully. We'll experience misery if we act unskillfully. To put it, it's rather simplistic. In some ways, it's more complex than that. But let's keep it simple for the moment. So we need to be much more sensitive and attuned to this. In a way, it's quite sort of straightforward. You know, sometimes I have the experience of somebody coming to me, really sort of miserable, resentful, moaning. And you ask them, well, have you been meditating? Have you been doing puja? Have you been meeting spiritual friends? No, no. What have you been doing? Well, what do you expect? As American friends say, do the math. You know, the sums add up. You are like this because you have not been practicing the Dharma. It's not just a mistake. It's not just bad luck. You've been doing stuff or not doing stuff with your mind. Nothing is lost. The Yogacara, of course, have a way of trying to understand this with this wonderful sort of vision, if you like, of what they call the Alaya Vijnana, the store consciousness, which they say is like a torrent that goes on. It's completely unconscious. We can never know the Alaya. But they're saying all of our volitional activities of body, speech and mind are constantly seeding that stream or perfuming that stream. You can imagine it, unskillful volitions is like we're actually polluting that stream. You know, we talk about, you know, the ecology, but what about the ecology of consciousness? What about the stink and the, you know, the septic stuff that we're putting in the depths of our consciousness? But we can also perfume it beautifully with skillfulness. And when conditions arise, that perfume or that stink or those seeds are kind of activated. And that's how we experience the results of our actions. So in that sense, nothing is lost. This is actually very inspiring. You don't have to be sort of, don't be too depressed about this and think, oh my goodness, you know, all of these unskillful states, oh dear, you know, I'm going to have a terrible rebirth. Well, you can think like that if it inspires you to really do something. But also, it's inspirational because it means nothing skillful, no skillful volition is lost. That's an amazing thought, an amazing thought. We can always do something. And in relation to this, I think we need to realize that passivity is an action, passivity. I think in, certainly in the West, I notice a lot of passivity. People are sort of passive and kind of indifferent to their quality of mind. We kind of put up with low-level resentment and blaming and negativity. Sangharakshita said we put up with it a bit like putting up with bad weather, you know, in the English, and bad weather. And we sort of drift along thinking it isn't having effect. It is. It is. You know, that sort of dull, moany, fault-finding mind is doing something to you. And be passive to that, that's going to end in disaster eventually, or probably just you'll come to the end of your life and you'll wonder, what on earth have you done? You've wasted it. But equally, more positively, let's not dwell on the negative because it's horrible, the smallest skillful action can turn into something great, can turn into something wonderful. The White Lotus Sutra is really strong on this. They say things in the White Lotus that even if you just offer a flower at the feet of the Buddha, you will gain full and perfect enlightenment. they say that. I mean, it's quite, you know, in time, and it's not going to happen just because you do that. But they're pointing to the fact that no skillful action, no skillful gesture will be wasted. I find that very, very encouraging. It's very important to constantly renew our positive volition. You've probably noticed how much in Buddhist tradition there is an emphasis on the making of vows and aspirations. But again and again, especially in the Mahayana and later Buddhism, constantly making aspirations. Sometimes if I've had a particularly, well, frankly, rough meditation, bad meditation, you know, I know there's no such thing as a bad meditation. Well, in my case, there is. You know, dull, falling asleep, can't concentrate, running down this avenue of negativity. What I do at the end of that, when the bell rings, I thought, well, I can't just leave it like that. I just said, okay, I feel defeated in this sit. Nonetheless, I recommit myself to wanting to develop skillful states. I'm committing myself to the development of skillfulness. It does make a difference. You know, even just that act does something. I leave the shrine room at least with a certain amount of dignity rather than sort of slinking out and, you know, raiding the toast or something. So if we want to transform society, we need to develop between us in the Sangha, within the order, within the Sangha of people who've asked for ordination, the wider Sri Ratna community, the wider community, a circle of friends and family and so on. We need to be developing a community that is living in accordance with the law of karma. It's one of the things that Sangharakshita says in his lecture, that if we want to affect society, we within society, like our miniature Buddhist community, need to become a far more ethically sensitive community. All of us living according to the law of karma. Which in its turn can affect the wider community. I mean, it's very interesting, a few experiences. So another more positive experience of being in India. 6th of December, much later on in the 1980s, a number of 6th of Decembers actually, the Indian order members and mitras would insist, I didn't particularly want to do this, but they insisted that we do a procession through the streets of Bombay, from Dr. Ambedkar's house, Rajgriha, down to what they call the Chapati, and near to Dr. Ambedkar's Chaitya, where his remains are, where I'd give a big program. I really didn't want to do it. I was quite happy to just do the talk. But no, come on, we're going to proclaim that we are Buddhists within this great city. So we go along holding candles, very still, so we could hold candles. And we were chanting Sabbe Sata Sukhi Hontu, going through these really busy Bombay streets, very, very mindfully, very, very positively. Women in blue saris, men in their blue shirts. I think I was an Anagarika then, so I was in yellow robes. I had to be at the head of it, which I really didn't want to be, but I'm terribly self-conscious. Needed a police escort. You know, if you have a march like that, you have to have the police with you. And people would stop and just watch us and even fold their hands to us. And there was a very, very positive feeling between us. I got over my self-consciousness. And I was talking to the order members about how the police felt about it. And they said, oh, they really like us doing it because we don't give any trouble. We don't shout slogans because it's so peaceful and because it's so harmonious. And we just follow the route that they line for us. So, you know, we're walking along, you know, with police, with their big lattes, tapping the ground and so on. So you can be a sort of example in that way. And the other thing was at the London Buddhist Centre recently, for the they had a hustings in the shrine room, in front of the Rupa. So the candidates for the general election, Labour, UKIP, Tory, Liberal Democrat, they were all there answering questions. What was really interesting about it was the way these politicians respected the space. and how much they commented on how positive the space was. And the Labour candidate who actually came to power, she said it was the best of the hustings in the London Borough of Tower Hamlets. It was the best audience, the best atmosphere. And I felt immensely proud that, that the centre was holding up something. And they didn't, you know, they didn't have a big argument. They were very, very respectful of the space. So we can be in very small ways, and I'm sure there's other ways. People sometimes tell me that the effect they have in their workplace, that people know that they're a Buddhist and they know that they can really rely on this person and the kind of harmony that the person brings to the workplace. I've heard of that. So this brings us back to the theme of confession, which is so central to the Sutra of Golden Light. And we've been doing long confessions, haven't we, in the evening, in the puja. And as I've already said, the confession in the Sutra of Golden Light is extremely thorough. There's verse after verse covering all aspects of body, speech and mind. There are even confessions made, and we had them last night, confessions made for faults, for evil, committed under very, very difficult circumstances. And these difficult circumstances are called the oppressions. Do you remember that from last night? The evil that I've done under the oppression of existence, the oppression of the arrival of evil friends, the oppression of impurities, the oppression of the moment. I take that to mean that suddenly you're put on the spot and you have to do something, you end up doing something unskillful, and so on and so forth. The impressions of thirst and hunger. Bhante, in his commentary on this, said the word for oppression is sankata, which also means closed, narrow, crowded together, dense, critical condition. It's as if life is sort of squeezing you and pressing in on you, and you sort of can't help but act unskillfully. You know, it's a funny way of putting it, but that seems to be what's being said. There's this, I think, this deep insight and understanding here in whoever composed those verses into, you know, how we can end up being unskillful. It's not simply that we've got unskillful volitions. There are also circumstances which kind of exert pressure on us. This is why conditions are so important. It's why it's so important to put yourself in really positive conditions. It's also why it's important, why we have to develop very, very, very strong, skillful volitions. Very, very strong goodness to push back the really heavy conditions that we can be. It's also why we've got to, in the end, develop insight. You know, a goodness that can't be overturned. For Buddhists, real Buddhists, those who go for refuge, while it might be understandable that there are, you know, heavy pressures that result in skillfulness, nonetheless, as the Sutra of Golden Light makes clear, we have acted unskillfully. And we will suffer the effects of that unskillfulness. And our unskillfulness will impact on other people, regardless or anybody's doing out there, regardless of what's happening, we are responsible for our actions. And we need to take full responsibility for that. Buddhists do not, cannot excuse themselves. We cannot ever excuse ourselves for our unskillfulness. We do not blame. We do not justify. We do not rationalize. Do you remember that Tibetan monk who wrote, I think it was Fire Under the Snow, when he was in the prison camp, treated terribly, and he was asked, you know, were you afraid? Yes, I was afraid of losing bodhicitta. I was afraid because I'd get so angry and resentful that I would lose my connection with love and compassion. Not fear of death. You know, not fear of injury, but the loss of skillfulness, the loss of love and compassion. So the path of the Dhamma is a path of radical individual responsibility. The path of the Dhamma is a path of radical individual responsibility. We need to be cultivating that between us. You know, really being responsible with one another within the spiritual community. And we need to be exemplifying that to others, even teaching that to others. In his lecture, Bhante talks about how important the family is in this respect, and how the family as a unit needs to be, a Buddhist family, you need as a parent to be encouraging skillfulness, to be running the family according to the law of karma. In traditional Buddhist tradition, one's parents are one's first gurus, one's first teachers, because they teach and exemplify the basics of human life. And especially, parents teach ethics and teach actions, that actions have consequences. And it's very interesting, the Buddha, there are stories of the Buddha meeting children. There's one famous story, again in the Udana, very early, where these boys they found an injured crow. And as boys will do, they've got a stick and they're tormenting this crow, making it squawk and do, you know, dance around, and they're laughing. And the Buddha sees them and he spoke to them of empathy. He just said, look, if I were to take a stick to you, or if somebody were to take a stick to you, would it hurt? And of course the Buddha's presence makes them stop, and they said, yes, it would hurt. So it hurts that animal, it hurts that creature in doing that. It's exactly the same. It's the same for all creatures. So put down the rod, put down the stick. So establishing the community, the ethical community, the moral order, has to start early on, and it needs to run through all of our activities. Yes, run through the whole Sangha. If the golden light, we've got to have a chance of the golden light transforming the social order, it's got to start with us. So speaking of that story of the Buddha and the children and the boys really brings me to the most fundamental ethical rule of all, the ethical rule of life. It's called, in Western tradition, the golden rule, which is basically treating others as you would treat yourself. Do unto others as you do unto yourself. This is, it's interesting that this is found all over the world in one way or another, but in Buddhist tradition, it's followed through thoroughly and never compromised. True Buddhist tradition. So the golden rule is that we know that we want to be happy. You know, when we look at ourselves, we want to be happy. We want to avoid pain. We want to be free of fear. We want to feel secure. We want to feel safe. We want to feel protected. We want to have a sense of well-being. We want to be treated well. Of course we do. We all fear death. We all fear loss. All those things. You know, just get down to those, you know, basic kind of existential kind of desires, if you like, and recognize them. Every single creature is exactly the same as ourselves in this respect. Nobody is different from us in this respect. The Shantideva calls this particular insight the insight into paramata, paratma samatha, the realization of the sameness of self and others. And it's part of his perfection of meditation section in the Bodhicharyavatara. It's interesting. That is the perfection of meditation, to realize that we are the same as all others, the same as all life. In this respect, we want to be free of sorrow, and we want to be free, and we want to be filled with happiness and well-being. And he talks about, instead of thinking of yourself, extend an attitude of love and protectiveness and tender-heartedness to all of life, to all living beings, to each and every living being. It's very interesting. I think this is also why a key to the whole business of boundless loving kindness. You don't actually need to know anything about others other than the fact that they want to avoid sorrow and they want to be happy. That's the basis of love. Love for all others. Love for all life. This is the basis of the first precept, abstaining from killing living beings, and love, the principle of love, loving kindness. So this golden rule is the fundamental Buddhist ethic. It's the fundamental of the Dhamma. It's the fundamental, actually, of the Dhamma revolution. And Dr. Ambedkar goes into this beautifully in his book, The Buddha and His Dhamma. He has a very, very interesting discussion on morality and Dhamma in his book. He says, what replaces God in Buddhism is the Dhamma, and by Dhamma, he means morality. This replaces God in Buddhism. Not that Dhamma's created the universe, and not morality's created the universe, but it's what governs the universe. And he comes up with this famous aphorism, Dhamma manje niti, niti manje dhamma. Correct, yes. Morality speakers? Dhamma is morality, morality is dhamma. What does he mean by morality? He says morality is the direct necessity for every human being to treat every other human being with respect, with reverence, with love, without any discrimination. Very important. Without any discrimination. In other words, you see every single living being as another living being, other human beings as other human beings, like yourself. And of course, he's probably also here referencing that wonderful Marathi word, manuski, which means something like humanness. Again, we don't get the force of it in English because it's opposed to seeing somebody as a caste member or a class member. You see them primarily as a human being, manuski, human beingness. You see them according to Dhamma, according to morality. You feel their living beingness primarily and you revere and respect that. In religion, theistic religion, Dr. Ambedkar says morality in this sense is detachable. It's a bit like the cart can be taken away from how it's being led. It really depends on God's mood whether or not you follow morality in this. Sometimes, yes, you love your neighbour as yourself, but if God's in a different mood, you punish that person. But Dr. Ambedkar says that in Buddhism, Dhamma, morality, love, respect for others, manuski, is sacred and universal. This is another wonderful insight. Sacred. It's holy. It's the most holy thing. It's more holy than pilgrimage. It's more holy than going to sacred places. That the sacred act is to treat every single living being with this quality of attention, of respect, and of love. And it's universal. It's for absolutely every occasion, in relation to every single living being. It's the most holy thing, and it's for everywhere. William Blake has that wonderful saying, everything that lives is holy. Amazing. Sangharakshita believes that this particular passage in Dr. Ambedkar's book reveals his deepest thinking. And in saying this, of course, Dr. Ambedkar is in effect telling his followers and his disciples, telling Indian Buddhists, telling world Buddhists, that Dhamma, morality, love, is primary, is fundamental. And it's the basis for what he calls the kingdom of the Dhamma, the basis of the Dhamma revolution. It's very interesting, this, because of course, Dr. Ambedkar in his speeches and writings is absolutely, strident and outspoken, and he's like a thunderbolt, like a vajra against caste and injustice and against the terrible practices of caste Hinduism and everything goes with it. But he's also equally fierce in relation to his own community, to the Dalit community, for them to take responsibility for themselves, to take responsibility for their mental states, and to not accept this situation, and to embrace the Dhamma in this way, this radical taking of responsibility in relation to practicing the Dhamma. So it brings to mind, of course, the Buddha here in the Dhammapada, very early verse, right early on in the section of the pairs. Not by hatred are hatreds ever pacified here in the world. They are pacified by love. This is the eternal law. Not by hatred are hatreds ever pacified here in the world. They are pacified by love. This is the eternal law. The Dhamma Sanatana. This is the way things are. This is the natural law. Actually, we're coming here. We're going, I think, beyond karma niyama. We're moving into dharma niyama. We're moving into the realm of the transcendental. We're moving into goodness, which doesn't just come from karma, but comes from another source entirely. It comes from the bodhicitta, the golden light. And as Shantideva says, ordinary goodness loses its fruit, like the banana tree, and just decays. But that tree, which is the bodhicitta, begets and does not decay. It bears fruit perpetually. And he says it's only the bodhicitta, only the transcendental force of the enlightened consciousness that can actually push back the darkness in the end in this world. So we're talking here about the golden light. That's what we've got to get in touch with. That's what we have to invoke, the golden light of this force of love, if we're going to transform our fundamental relationship with one another, if we're going to bring about a transformation of society. This is what we need to bring into this broken and lawless world of ours. And we begin with ourselves. We begin with ourselves. We begin with one another. We begin with our families. We begin with our communities. We begin within the Sangha. We begin with the people in our workplace. We begin with our brothers and sisters in the Sangha. We make this golden light strong within us so that we can really bring something to this world. We begin by taking full responsibility for ourselves, for our skillfulness. Bhante ends his lecture series with a quote, a wonderful aspiration from the Sutra of Golden Light, from a section called Abundance of Lotuses, an aspiration made by somebody called Suvarna Bhujendra, whatever that might mean. So I'm going to read it. And after he reads it, Sangharakshita says, both now and in the years to come, may this be the aspiration of us all. So, may this be the aspiration of us all. By proclaiming the Suvarna Prabhasa, the golden light, may the ocean of evil be dried up for me. May the ocean of acts be destroyed for me. May the ocean of impurities be destroyed for me. May the ocean of merit be filled for me. May the ocean of knowledge be purified for me. By the excellent splendor of flawless knowledge, may I become the ocean of all virtues, filled with jewel-like virtues, with the virtues of enlightenment. By the power of the golden light in its confession, may there be for me splendor of merits. May the splendor of enlightenment be pure for me. By the excellent splendor of flawless knowledge, may there be splendor of body for me. By the shining splendor of my merit, may I become distinguished in the whole triple world, continually endowed with the power of merit, a liberator from the ocean of woe, and like a sea of all blessing, may I proceed to enlightenment with all sentient beings.